Good afternoon, everyone. For those of you who don't know, I'm Christopher Manfredi, Dean of the Faculty of Arts, and it's my pleasure this afternoon to welcome you to this year's Kundal Prize lecture. Before we get started with our proceedings this afternoon, I just want to say a little bit about the Kundal Prize in Historical Literature. The late Peter Kundal was an interesting fellow. I had the opportunity to meet with him in London a few times. He was a graduate of McGill, although a commerce graduate of McGill, but he had a passion for history, and he made his life in the finance industry, building investment funds, and he always said that he felt an affinity towards history because his job as an investment counselor was to understand the past in order to understand the future and the present and to help his clients make money. He wanted to recognize and promote both literary and academic achievement in history, as well as to encourage people to read good history. And for that reason, he established the McGill Kundal Prize in Historical Literature, which we refer to in short form as the Kundal Prize, to be offered each year by McGill University to an individual of any nationality, from any country, who has published a book determined to have had, or likely to have, a profound literary, social, and academic impact in the area of history. The prize is, I think, one of the world's largest prizes for nonfiction books. There are actually three prizes. There's a grand prize of $75,000 U.S. and two recognition of excellence prizes of $10,000 each. The recipients of the prize are selected by an independent jury of at least five internationally distinguished and qualified individuals selected by the university. I should also add that when Mr. Kundal and I were discussing the prize, I had an unusually brilliant idea of asking him in the midst of a telephone call whether he would be willing not only to help acknowledge current achievements in historical scholarship, but to help McGill train the next generation of historical scholars by adding to the prize two $25,000 per year doctoral fellowships in history. And he very quickly over the phone said yes. So not only does the Kundal Prize provide recognition, significant public and financial recognition for great accomplishments in historical writing every year, it also helps McGill support graduate studies in history through the Kundal Fellows Program. And, of course, as part of the prize, we have the Kundal Lecture. We invite the previous year's winner to come back to McGill to give a lecture. And our thought is that having given someone a check for $75,000, they can't really decline our invitation to come and give us a lecture. The prize has spotlighted authors from a variety of regions, including Stuart Schwartz, the first winner from the United States, Lisa Jardine from the United Kingdom, Dermot McCulloch from the United Kingdom, and Sergio Luzzatto, who's here with us today somewhere. I don't know if he's made it back from his hotel, from Italy. And, of course, the 2012 winner, Stephen Platt, who is today's lecturer. But first, before I turn the podium over to Hans Beck, who will introduce this year's speaker, I want to tell you that today the Kundal jury met, and we had announced our short list of six books last month in September, and today we met throughout the day to narrow down the short list of six books to the three finalists, each of which will win a prize, and then the grand prize will be revealed on November 20th in a ceremony that we're doing this year in Toronto. So let me announce the three finalists for the Kundal Prize for this year. I'm announcing them in alphabetical order, so if you're inclined to bet, you can't put yourself an advantage by reading anything into the order with which I'm giving the three finalists. So the first finalist is Anne Applebaum, for her book, Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1944 to 1956. The second finalist for this year is Christopher Clark, for his book, The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914. And the third book is Frederick Logival's book, Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire, and the Making of America's Vietnam. So I want to congratulate those three finalists. They will all be in Toronto, as far as I know, on November 20th to hear the announcement of the winner. All three of them have, of course, already won, and one of them will win a little bit more than the others. And I look forward to meeting all three of the authors in Toronto in November. I'd also like you to note that on your seats you will see coupons, which are available to purchase all past Kundal book award winners, as well as this year's current list from the McGill Bookstore for a 20% discount. So take that coupon with you and take advantage of it. Now I'd like to ask my colleague Hans Beck, Professor of Ancient History, the John McNaughton Chair of Classics, and Director of Classical Studies, to come to the podium and introduce Professor Platt. Hans.
Good evening. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce to you the winner of the 2012 Kundal Prize in Historical Literature. Dr. Stephen Platt is professor in the Department of History at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He received his PhD from Yale University in 2004. In his thesis, he examined the rediscovered writings of a hermit scholar in China's Hunan province in the first half of the 19th century, and the influence of these writings on future provincial reformers, including Mao Zedong. His PhD research resulted in the publication of his first book, Provincial Patriots, The Hunanese and Modern China, published by Harvard University Press in 2007. At UMass, he teaches courses on modern Chinese history from the 17th century to the present day, as well as seminars on U.S.-Chinese relations, comparative nationalism, and the writing of history. From 2008 to 2010, he was a fellow of the Public Intellectuals Program of the National Committee on U.S.-Chinese Relations. Occasionally, he gives talks on modern and contemporary China to audiences in education and government, and also to the general public. Prior to completing his PhD in Chinese history, he spent time as Fulbright Fellow in Taiwan and 2 years as Yale China teacher in the Hunan province, which was formative to his later career. I recently read an interview with Dr. Platt in the McGill Reporter where he reveals, quote, "I never intended to become a historian. I was a math major who ended up in the English department. It was only in the course of a 2-year teaching position in the Hunan province that I began to take serious interest in how the past and present interweave," end of quote. So Dr. Platt's academic journey diverted at some point. Like Dante, who writes, "In the middle of the journey, I found myself astray in a dark wood where the straight road was lost," Dr. Platt took a different path at some point. It led him, among other distinctions, to the Kundal Prize in 2012, awarded for his second book, Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom, China, the West, and the Epic Story of the Taiping Civil War. The jury was captivated by Dr. Platt's description of China in the 1860s, not as some exotic or enigmatic kingdom that was ever so removed from the course of the events in the West, but rather a country deeply integrated into the world's economy, with multiple ties to foreign states and, in fact, home to thousands of foreigners. The book opens a unique almost dazzling window into the troubled corner of the world of the 19th century. But it can also be read as a moral tale, one of conscience and fate, set against the backdrop of a falling empire. In the words of Dr. Platt, and forgive me when I cite a paragraph-long passage from his book here, but it speaks volumes, I believe, to his achievement as a scholar and writer. So in the words of the author, quote, "The Chinese characters at the center of this book did not have the luxury the foreigners did of escaping. It was their world to make or destroy. As it pertains to them, this is the story of a handful of individuals torn from the fabric of their familiar lives and thrust into roles of historical consequence beyond anything they had ever dreamt. It is about deliberate choices from which one can never turn back, the acts that, once committed, can never be undone, and the relentless erosion of options in times of crisis, until nothing else remains but to push forward into the cataclysm in hopes of somehow finding peace on the other side." End of quote. The topic of his presentation tonight takes us one generation or so further back in time, to the beginnings of the so-called Opium War in 1839. The title is Imperial Eclipse, The Long Road to the First Anglo-Chinese War. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the winner of the 2012 Kandel Prize in Historical Literature, Dr. Stephen Platt.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's impossible to overstate what an honor it is to be here, and I thank you. I thank you, Hans, for the introduction. Thank you, Dean Manfredi, and especially I thank the memory of the late Peter Kundel for endowing this prize. It's still utterly remarkable to me that somebody in his line of work would have endowed a prize for somebody in my line of work. And if it's any consolation, one of the lessons that I've drawn from my preliminary research into the Opium War era is that Chinese foreign relations work much better when the investors and the traders are in charge of things rather than governments and diplomats. But we can come back to that later. I would also say that it's utterly humbling to win a prize like this, and I don't think anyone could stand up here to give this lecture without feeling that they were chosen by accident, which I'm sure that I was. But it's a happy kind of an accident, and so I'll try to give some sort of a payback. Now, in trying to think about what to talk about today, I decided not to talk about the Taiping Rebellion. My talks on the Taiping have, over time, become somewhat pat because I've given a lot of them, and I thought you deserve something a little fresher and more open-ended. So I'm actually going to be sort of sharing what's been occupying my interest for the past year or so since I won the prize. This is a subject that's much newer to me. It's still quite open-ended. The conclusions are still tentative, and hopefully in the course of trying to articulate it for you and what to me makes it so interesting tonight, I can sort of help move it forward. Now, Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom was about the Taiping Rebellion, as you said, which was in mid-19th century China. My current project begins earlier. The Taiping Rebellion was about a decade or so after the Opium War, a time when China was verging on collapse. There were sectarian societies, corrupt officials, a weak emperor, loss of control. And it's from that sort of miasma that the Taiping Rebellion exploded. At the time that the Taiping Rebellion broke out, Karl Marx, who was a reporter at the time, blamed it all on the British for having fought the Opium War. And as he characterized it in his writings, the British had sort of cracked ancient China open in like a mummy, like a hermetically sealed mummy exposed to the air, decay, and it would naturally set in and it would all collapse. And this was a prevailing vision of what had gone wrong in China. It wasn't just Marx, it was also other British observers who didn't have any reason to know better, who believed, and this belief does sort of carry on, that essentially China's downfall was precipitated by Britain fighting the Opium War, as if it were Britain that had sort of single-handedly brought China to its knees. Back then, they had very little knowledge of what had gone on inside China at that time. Surprisingly little research has been done until recently on the decades prior to the Opium War. I would say the Opium War itself has been taken as sort of the official starting point for modern Chinese history, that the modern era begins with the humiliation of the Opium War. Successive generations in China were dedicated to trying to undo the disasters of the 19th century. And treating it in that way sets it in time, sort of as a frozen moment of time. When we think about precedents for the Chinese state today, the precedents that we look to don't generally ever go back beyond about 1839, as if nothing had really happened before then. And what we're left with is a vision as if China had always been weak compared to Europe, as if China had no real military prowess and was unable to muster against threats at its borders. It was as if Chinese officials were simply insensible to Britain's rising power. And also, I mean, most ironically, that China was uninterested in trade. This became sort of a commonplace, that Britain had to fight the Opium Wars because China did not want trade. However, we know now that in the 18th century, the wealthier parts of eastern China were every bit as prosperous as Western Europe. There were wealthy merchant networks stretching throughout Southeast Asia. We know that the Manchu dynasty that led China successfully fought massive wars in Central Asia, that they were the preeminent military power in Central Asia. They ruled over an empire with subjects in the hundreds of millions over vast amounts of wealth and trade. There were emperors who reigned for more than half a century each, some of them. And if we turn the clock back, and if we sort of skip past the Opium War and look at the earlier era, we can start in an 18th century where China was the model for the West of stable government, a time when it was admired admired for its economy, for its order, for its stability, for its principles of government. How was it brought so low by the 19th century? The process begins well before the Opium War. So let's go back and look. We can start with the view from outside. That's really the inherited one we get. Adam Smith in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations writes, China has long been one of the richest, that is, one of the most fertile, best cultivated, most industrious, and most populous countries in the world. It seems, however, to have been long stationary. But, he corrects himself, he says, though it's stationary, it is not going backwards. It was viewed as an empire that had reached just a peak of productivity and industry and was sort of holding steadily at that point. 1794, a Dutch embassy successfully visited Beijing. The interpreter for that embassy was a newly minted American citizen. And when he wrote his account of the embassy to Beijing, he dedicated it to George Washington. Again, this is 1794. And in the dedication, he singled out writing to George Washington, he called upon the virtues which in your excellency afford so striking a resemblance between Asia and America, that George Washington was a model of what they had already achieved in Asia. And he goes on in this introduction to say that he hopes that Washington might procure for the United States a duration equal to that of the Chinese Empire. So 1794. British didn't have such a good time of it when they tried to open any kind of diplomatic negotiations in China. Trade had gone on since the 17th century. But it was as good a place to start anywhere with sort of the building British frustration diplomatically with China. Is in 1759, there was one Englishman who could speak Chinese. His name was James Flint. He had been orphaned, brought by a ship's captain to Canton to hopefully become useful by learning Chinese. And he was the East India Company's lone English interpreter. And they sent him on a ship, unfortunately named the Success, up the coast of China to bring a petition in Chinese to the emperor asking for him to expand British trade up the coast and various other sorts of things. Making a long story short, the emperor was furious upon receipt of this petition, which Flint had to bribe coastal officials to send on up to Beijing. James Flint was put into prison for 3 years for having broken with protocol, for having written in Chinese. The teaching of Chinese to foreigners was outlawed, and poor James Flint's Chinese teachers were beheaded. I should say that Flint was banished from China afterwards. The Chinese sources generally say that he then died. But I'm happy to report that he pops up about 10 years later teaching Benjamin Franklin how to make tofu. So he survived and found something useful to do. But from that moment on, from 1760 all the way up until the Opium War, after this Flint incident, all British trade was limited to the one single port city of Canton in South China. All trade had to go through there. And it was limited to one set of Chinese traders within that city. It would be extremely profitable, but the British would always want more. And essentially, one of the reasons they would always want more is because what the British really had to export was woolen goods, and nobody in South China near Canton wanted wool. And they hoped that if they could get a northern port, they would have a much better market for those sorts of things. 1793, the British tried sending the Macartney mission. It made it to Beijing and then failed, and they were sent packing. In 1816, they sent another embassy under Lord Amherst. This was on the heels of the grand victory over Napoleon, the pinnacle of British power. That mission also failed, and it was also sent packing after erupting into near violence in Beijing. And the poor Amherst mission also suffered a shipwreck on the way home. So this was the growing view of China from the outside of the British, that it was bursting with riches, but that they just wouldn't let the British into it. And if the British could somehow just get further outposts along the course, they could get rich like the Chinese were. But I should say that in contrast to Adam Smith, or in contrast to that interpreter from the Dutch embassy, Macartney, who was deeply humiliated by the failure of his embassy, came home with a much darker view of China. And he claimed that it was rotten to the core, and that it was like an old creaking man of war that sort of looked pretty fine from a distance, but if you get up close, you can see that it's leaking and ready to fall apart. And he predicted that the Chinese Empire would fall within his own lifetime. It did not. But foreigners have been making predictions like this for many generations now. What did it look like from the inside, though? What Macartney couldn't see, what Lord Amherst couldn't see. Macartney in 1793 had come during the late Qianlong era, during the reign of the Emperor Qianlong, who was one of the greatest rulers in China's entire history. He was a Manchu who would rule for an unprecedented 63 years. He officially stepped down after 60 so as not to outdo his grandfather, who had ruled for 61. But really, he held on to the reins of power. Qianlong carved out the borders of China that, for the most part, endure today, with the exception of Mongolia, largely. But at the time that Macartney came, we're nearing the end of Qianlong's reign. And this is when disorder began to set in. And Macartney's predictions of unrest were actually quite correct, and I still don't understand how or what where his information had come from, that he was able to sense sort of growing ground-level discontent. But the final years of Qianlong's rule were marked by enormous sectarian uprisings. Groups loosely lumped together under the so-called White Lotus, who were sort of millennial Buddhists formed from healing sects that rose in a time of incredible population increase. The peace and prosperity that China enjoyed under Qianlong also meant that between 1760 and 1790, the population had gone up from 200 to 300 million people. This put enormous pressure on resources, enormous pressures on the population. The government in 1794-1795 began persecuting the White Lotus sects, leading to uprisings. This is a similar pattern that we see at the beginning of the Taiping Rebellion, that a religious organization largely devoted to sort of healing practices is sort of suppressed by the government and then metastasizes and becomes a military organization. But in any case, the uprisings begin. And soon after Macartney has left China, you have all-out warfare in several provinces of China. It ultimately affects five provinces. The suppression of these massive uprisings fell into the hands of local militias that were raised sort of in an ad hoc manner. Untrained troops set loose against White Lotus villages, who ultimately proved even more destructive than the rebels that they had been sent to fight. In looking through the sources from the suppression of the White Lotus, there are a lot of echoes of the horrifying things that I found in the records from the Taiping. One observer in Hubei province in 1796 wrote that if the rebels are the rake, then the militias are the fine-toothed comb, and that any damage that was done by the rebels, when the militia come through, they destroy everything left behind. There are accounts of militia troops cutting people open, eating organs, accounts of emptied villages with wild pigs feeding on corpses, scorched earth warfare fought against these huge areas of you can't even call it civil war because it was so disorganized. But suffice it to say that in the 19th century, when the Taiping arose, fortunately for the dynasty, Zheng Guofan also arose. He's one of the central figures in my book. And he was a deeply reverent, disciplined Confucian who took charge of the militias at the time and built them into an extremely disciplined army. By contrast, in the 1790s, the officials who led the campaigns against the White Lotus were wildly corrupt. They embezzled millions of taels of silver, about three taels to an English pound. And the campaigns kept expanding. Again, this is the end of Qianlong's era. By 1798, there were nearly 400,000 militia soldiers on the books in Hubei province alone. In Sichuan, there were 300,000. In Shanxi, there were 260,000, at least being claimed by the militia leaders. How did it get to this point? Qianlong at this point had reigned for 60 years. He was in his 80s. He was clearly senile in his final years. The best sources we have on that are from Korean ambassadors who had longer stays at the capital than McCartney did. And a Korean ambassador in 1794 took note that Qianlong had reordered his breakfast right after finishing it, and that he changed his hat at whim. There were very careful rituals that involved the changing of hats, but he would just put another one on. In 1798, another Korean ambassador reported that he was becoming more and more forgetful. And he said, he forgets today what happened yesterday. He is oblivious in the evening of what occurred in the morning. And this leads to bemusement on the part of his attendants. Now, Qianlong's son, who would rule as the Jiaqing emperor, officially came to power in 1796, but he was unable to govern as long as his father was still alive. And sort of the heartbreaking thing about this is that Jiaqing knew how corrupt and violent the militias were that were fighting the White Lotus campaigns, but there was nothing that he could do about it until his father died in 1799. In the meantime, Qianlong had entrusted enormous amounts of power to a courtier named He Shan, who would ultimately be scapegoated for much larger official corruption at work at the end of Qianlong's reign. Jiaqing would have He Shan executed. He was allowed to strangle himself with a silk cord. This was the polite kind of execution, but only after Qianlong had died, and only after an incredible amount of damage had been done to the national treasuries. He Shan himself was accused of having embezzled property to the tune of 800 million taels of silver, which, for reference, was roughly $1 billion at the prevailing exchange rates at the time. Several houses with several hundred rooms each, more than 100,000 acres of farmland, entire storehouses of gems and gold. So the amount that He Shan was in his trial was accused of having stolen from the national treasuries amounted to about double the United States GDP in the year 1800. This was absurd. He did not. He Shan was scapegoated. Only recently have scholars dug enough into the records of He Shan's own possessions to realize that he didn't have anywhere near that amount of money. The important thing, though, is that he was the tip of the iceberg, and the crimes that were pinned on him, as has happened at other times in Chinese history, were a cathartic release during an era of corruption, of Jiaqing pinning all of the corruption of all of the officials in China on this one figure and having him executed as a way of trying to start a new era of more discipline and more order. But the damage had been done. There's an excellent scholar at William Patterson University, Dai Yingsong, who has done some wonderful research on this era. She's found that the White Lotus Wars were dragged out for years after they could have ended by military commanders who were enriching themselves with government funds, and they knew that if they won the war, that those funds would dry up. So we inherit, and here's where we come back to the Opium War, we inherit a vision of Opium War era China where the military is underfunded, untrained, nearly useless against the British. And as the story is handed down, it becomes a commonplace that perhaps China was always that way. But it was not. And in fact, military spending had been a major priority of government up until the White Lotus campaigns. If anything, China overfunded its military until the beginning of the 19th century. And then in response to the corruption of those campaigns, military funding was slashed, budgets for purchasing weapons were slashed, and the military itself went into a sharp decline as an attempt to pull it back from the heights of corruption it had reached. But this is how you get the very weak military that the British engaged with in the Opium War, that it's a legacy of that enormous campaign. So the dynasty was left with crushing expenses from the war, roughly 120 million taels, about 40 million British pounds, spent on the White Lotus campaigns. Probably half of those went to unrelated expenses put into the pockets of military commanders. Meanwhile, at the same time, Britain was fighting the Napoleonic Wars over the face of the Earth's surface, and it emerged from that period with the preeminent navy in the world. Excellent land forces, but above all, Britain had the best navy in the world. China's military embroilment at the same time was on land in the mountains, developing methods of sort of fortified village warfare, of scorched earth, of ways of counterinsurgent suppression at a time when Britain was perfecting its naval power. This would have great repercussions. The bureaucracy in China is such that it took years to reconfigure towards a new strategy or a new style of recruitment or a new style of fighting. So what about China's naval forces? Did China have naval forces to speak of? Actually, simultaneously with the White Lotus, there was an enormous problem of piracy in China along the south coast. The pirates generally took advantage of the vacuum created by the White Lotus campaigns in the interior. This happens repeatedly in Chinese history, that internal and waterborne threats coincide. Even if they have no necessary connection to each other, they are able to take advantage of each other's existence because the government generally needs to focus on one or over the other. The leader of the pirates was a woman named Zheng Yisao, or Lady Zheng, as she was known. She was the great pirate captain of the early 19th century, a former prostitute who had married a pirate leader in 1801. She took over after his death in 1807. By the end of the first decade of the 19th century, she had over 400 ships under her command, with estimates range from 40 to 70,000 pirates in her army, ravaging the southern coast of China. But very importantly, in contrast to the extermination of the White Lotus, the pirates were not defeated by a Qing navy. And in fact, the pirates generally triumphed over Qing naval forces when they fought them. And in the end, they were appeased. They negotiated a surrender in 1810, and many of the pirates were allowed to keep the proceeds of their piracy in exchange for agreeing not to continue as pirates. Furthermore, and this is one of the wonderful twists, several of their leaders were brought into the Qing Navy to serve under them. And Zheng Yisao's adopted son was made a lieutenant in the Qing Navy, given money to establish his followers on shore. Zheng Yisao herself lived to the then relatively ripe old age of 60 as a happy and wealthy citizen, after having surrendered. And this process of bringing the pirates in, I would say that the wondrous assumption behind that is that ultimately what anyone in the entire region of China would want is an official position within the bureaucracy, because that's what everybody wanted. I mean, if you look at the Taiping Rebellion, the leader of the Taiping rebels, the self-imagined son of God, had spent the first half of his life trying to be a civil servant and trying to take the civil service exams in hopes of becoming a government official. And then when that failed and he had his breakdown, then he decided to overthrow the entire thing. But do note the calculation to exterminate the White Lotus rebels but appease the pirates. This is a recognition of where their military strengths lay, and it was also a calculation of where they could most successfully appease and where they could most successfully develop their forces. So, in fact, the Qing diverted forces from coastal defense to the White Lotus areas. Tens of thousands of coastal soldiers were sent out to the White Lotus campaigns. And the shift from fighting to appeasement is going to be a key to the outcome of the Opium War. where the outsiders were sort of baffled at how quickly China decided to go from fighting the British to suddenly offering to sign an agreement with them that granted them almost everything they asked for. Okay. In the middle here, let's now go into Canton. This is the world in between the rising Britain and the deeply embroiled China. At Canton, all through these many, many, many years where British trade was limited to Canton, the British, and I should say specifically here, the East India Company, which had a monopoly on all British trade to Canton until 1833, the British bought tea and silk. The Chinese bought cotton, other textiles, and increasingly they bought opium at Canton. Opium began at a fairly small scale. Usage, it was originally a luxury item for the very wealthy in China, but in the early 19th century it began to spread from high to low. It became cheaper as the British developed better stocks, cheaper stocks of it from India. The East India Company, because of its monopoly, controlled all British trade at Canton. And so it controlled the opium trade, which, however, because it was illegal, the company itself stayed hands-off on the opium. And they would sell the opium at auction in Calcutta. Country traders, mostly Parsis, would then ship it to Canton, where they would sell it illegally, and they would take the proceeds and use that to pay back for, their expenses from India. So it was grown under the auspices of the East India Company in India. It was sold by company ships, for the most part, offshore. Americans got in on the trade as well. Because of the British monopoly in India, the Americans had to go to Turkey to buy their opium, and then sort of sail it from there over to Canton to make their own deals. However, only by 1823 did opium ultimately become the main export from India to Canton. That year, it finally supplanted cotton as the chief British export from India, and it rises very quickly from there. By 1828, the opium sold in Canton balanced out the value of the tea that was being bought there to be brought back to England, and the imbalance just kept going after that. There were ongoing moral debates constantly through these years, especially missionaries writing about the harms of the opium trade. There was hardly a British person who would argue that opium was good. Some would say, oh, it's, you know, it's no worse than gin. More likely they would say something like, oh, it's a Chinese habit, and who are we to try to tell the Chinese what their habits should be. In any case, there were, however, many conscientious voices, both in government and in the missionary communities, calling for an end to this vile practice. And by and large, the opium traders were looked down upon. They were drug smugglers. This was generally acknowledged. And one of the great ironies of the Opium War is that in the end, Britain wound up going to war for their sake, against that view that these are dirty drug traders. Similarly, there were debates within China about whether opium should be legalized or should it be suppressed. And there were arguments advanced on either side, whether they should try to do away with opium or whether it should be allowed and regulated in a way that ensured that. And ultimately, I mean, I would say that far more than the moral issue of opium at this time, the issue for Chinese officials was the loss of silver, silver that was being paid to buy the opium and then leaving the country, that this was creating a fiscal crisis, which is what ultimately brought things to a head in China. So, however, one thing was very clear up through the 1830s, which was that as much as British traders wanted greater access in China, and they were always hoping to open up more ports, even though they were limited to Canton, they were getting very rich. And furthermore, it was the Canton trade that made India profitable. By the 1820s, the East India Company was getting about five times as much profit from Canton as from their entire colony of India. Furthermore, the British government was being enriched by this trade thanks to its taxes on the tea that was being brought back to England, which at times reached 100%. At the time of the Opium War, one member of Parliament estimated that 1/6 of the entire annual revenue of Britain and India depended on the China trade. So for all of the moral questions of the function of opium within this trade, its importance to the overall British economy was almost unquestionable. I would add to this, however, that it was also one of the Qing dynasty's most reliable income streams, the Canton trade. I'll come back to that as well, that in times of disorder, in times of loss of tax bases to rebellion, the income coming in through Canton was essential. And in fact, with wars like the White Lotus and others, they would make huge exactions on the Chinese traders at Canton, who would donate millions of taels of silver for the war effort, on top of the roughly a million taels a year that was coming in for the duties on the tea that was being sold at Canton. So how did a trade that was so economically valuable to both sides give way to a war? And that, in a sense, is the crux of the matter. And this is the sort of thing that I used to think that I understood when I first started reading Chinese history, and I no longer think that I really understand why this should have ended up as a war. Very few people at the time seemed to expect one. Very few British thought that what they were doing was all that bad. They didn't think that this was something that the Chinese would ever seriously crack down on. And again, they say, well, you know, it's like drinking gin. It isn't something that's so morally terrible. And perhaps even more importantly, it appears that very few Chinese believed it to be a serious crime either. The officials of government did, certainly. Officials like Lin Zexu were deeply, deeply morally opposed to the opium trade, but not ordinary people. Melissa McCauley at Northwestern has done, again, excellent research on the region of Chaozhou in eastern Guangdong province, where she finds that there was actually very little prosecution of opium laws at the lower levels. Locals generally closed ranks around their own. There were entrenched village networks of distributors. And by and large, the opium trade at the lower level went on completely untouched by high-level campaigns from the government. Further to this, suppression simply did not seem to be a major issue for them. They were profiting from it. They saw it as a good kind of a trade. And it seems safe to say that in the 1830s, ordinary people in China didn't see this as much of a problem. Certainly not the kind of a problem that would lead to a war. I would note, sort of ancillary to this, that prior to the Opium War, prior to the actual arrival of gunships to enforce British trade in China, before that, it's impossible to separate blame for the opium traffic, to say that it was entirely due to the foreigners or that it was entirely due to Chinese, that it was obviously both. The foreigners got it near Canton, and everything in from there was in Chinese hands. The Opium War is often cast as being about China's inability to control foreign relations, but I would suggest that even more it was about China's growing inability to control its own population and the inability of China's government to stamp out the opium trade within the country on its own terms. So what about British pride in their military power? Why did it take so long for the gunships to arrive? Because nobody wanted a war in China. In 1808, the Napoleonic Wars came to China. Macau, which was a Portuguese colony, which is where the British traders had to live in the off-season when they weren't allowed in Canton. There was a rumor that the French, who had an alliance with the Portuguese, were coming to send troops, and they would shut out the British traders. So the British sent in a gunship. They attempted to take Macau by force in 1808, and they were driven out under Chinese fire. The British admiral abandoned his attempt to take Macau because he did not want a war with China. And as he wrote to the East India Company traders in Canton, he said that his greatest fear was the fiat of the emperor, which in this great subordinate dynasty would exclude the English forever from the most advantageous monopoly it possessed in the universe. And this is a recurrent message from government officials, from military officials on the British side in the years prior to the Opium War, that the only thing to be gained from trying to fight a war against China is to lose this incredibly lucrative trade that we have. China would simply shut it down. Again, in 1832, just 7 years before the Opium War broke out, the East India Company representatives in Canton asked for warships in another diplomatic, in a little tiff they were having in Canton. The East India Company directors in London wrote back to them saying, "We decidedly condemn the requisition you made to the Bengal government for the aid of ships of war. We have no pretensions beyond the subjects of other nations to dictate to the Chinese government the principles upon which they alone are to carry on her trade with foreigners." These are not the kinds of things one expects to find. Again, because of sort of this fixed notion of the Opium War, that the British always wanted war and they just bided their time, China had always been weak. At the same time, in 1832, the First Lord of the Admiralty wrote to the Governor General in India, quote, "Trade with China is our only object. Conquest there would be as dangerous as defeat, and commerce never prospers where force is used to sustain it. No glory is to be gained in a victory over the Chinese. So how did the war happen? The prelude is in 1833 when the East India Company's monopoly was lifted. As a victory for free trade, this meant a free-for-all of British merchants trying to leap into the extremely lucrative trade for tea and opium in Canton, which led to disorganization and competition, an incredible surge in the number of chests of opium being brought in, and ultimately, most important, that the British then had to send a government representative to Canton to supervise the British traders there. And his interactions with Chinese officials went sour almost immediately. Again, in tribute to Peter Kundal, the traders did a fairly good job of keeping peaceful relations. Every time Britain sent in a diplomat, it all fell apart. The actual spark for the war was in 1839 when the imperial commissioner, Lin Zexu, was sent to Canton by the emperor to suppress the opium trade. Again, even more than the moral question, it was an economic question, a perceived loss of silver. This, incidentally, has been heavily questioned recently by scholars in Chinese history. One in particular has argued strenuously that the loss of silver from the Chinese economy, or the shortage of silver at this time, likely had more to do with the revolution in Mexico than it did with anything having to do with the opium trade. But suffice it to say that the shared perception amongst leading officials was that silver was being lost through Canton to the foreign trade, and so it had to stop. Lin Zexu came to Canton. He demanded that the British hand over all of their opium stocks. He placed the foreign quarter under siege. When it was finally handed over, he destroyed it. His actions were taken by the British as high-handed, as being disrespectful of property. His fairly mild threats of violence against foreigners were generally exaggerated in the retelling. By the time the story got back to England, it was taken up as a nationalist cause. Sadly, what Lin Zexu's suppression of the foreign traffic at Canton represents is that Chinese officials could not control the opium traffic within China. And it was a much more direct route because they had a focused node at Canton for foreign trade, that was one place that they could go with real hope of choking off the traffic. Importantly, though, there's very strong evidence that Lin Zexu did not imagine that he would start a war. And similarly, the Daoguang emperor in sending him there had not intended to start a war with Britain. And it's still remarkable to me that Britain did go to war over this, again, because of the moral issue of the opium. Technically, the essential point in the middle of all of this is that the British superintendent of trade, Charles Elliot, convinced the British traders to hand over their opium by guaranteeing it in the name of the Queen. And so when Lin Zexu destroyed all of that opium, he was essentially destroying the property of Queen Victoria. And the government in England was then on the hook for paying back all of these opium dealers for all of their lost stock, which was about £3 million worth. So the business people went lobbying to Parliament, arguing nobody wanted to have to pay back the opium traders. But it was an extremely close vote that allowed this war to proceed in England. There was a motion for censure in the House of Commons, which passed by only 9 votes. I will, just to give some sense of what these people were saying at the time, James Graham, who introduced the motion, referred to China as being inhabited by 350 million human beings, all directed by the will of one man, all speaking one language, all governed by one code of laws, all professing one religion, all actuated by the same feelings of national pride and prejudice, tracing back their history not by centuries, but by tens of centuries, and going on about their civilization, their arts, and all of the conveniences and many of the luxuries of life existing there when Europe was still sunk in barbarism and when the light of knowledge was obscure in the Western Hemisphere. This was what began the debates. William Gladstone, in an incredibly long speech in April 8, 1840, decrying the notion of going to war for the sake of opium dealers, he argues that the British flag, quote, has always been associated with the cause of justice, with opposition to oppression, with respect for national rights, with honorable commercial enterprise, but now under the auspices of the noble lord, that's Palmerston, that flag is to be hoisted to protect an infamous contraband traffic. And if it were never to be hoisted except again again, except as it is now hoisted on the coast of China, we recoil from its sight with horror. And these continue. There are strenuous debates opposing the war. It's important to note that this term opium war, the cynical name for this war, came from the London Times. This is the term in England. The Times itself, on April 7th, 1840, called the business in China the case of a lawless and accursed traffic to be bolstered up by a flagitious and murderous war. China has been bullied and insulted. Her laws set it not within her own harbors. But again, the vote in Parliament passed by 9 votes. The war went ahead, and pretty soon everybody came on board once it could be characterized as a nationalist cause, as a redress of grievances, as protection of the property and livelihoods of British subjects in the harsh and cruel environment of China. And the war went ahead. And the war itself, well, it was almost a foregone conclusion at that point. It was fought largely on the water along the coast, with Britain's greatest strength being posed against China's greatest weaknesses. And although it dragged out in various ways, it ended decisively in favor of the British. In hindsight, it becomes the major watershed for Chinese Western relations in the 19th century, a template for everything that came afterwards. At the time, though, for Britain, it wasn't such a major event. Actually, the war in Afghanistan loomed much more largely to the British at the time. And to a certain extent, the same was true for China, in that it was very small compared to the White Lotus campaigns. Just as, and this is something I talked about in Autumn, the Heavenly Kingdom, just as the Second Opium War, which was no less important, paled in size in comparison to the Taiping Rebellion that it coincided with, although we sometimes forget that these were happening at the same times. When we forget the simultaneity, or when we forget how the massive White Lotus campaigns, 1 million militia soldiers, preceded the much smaller Opium War, when we forget that the massive Taiping Rebellion with 20 million dead overlapped with the much smaller Second Opium War, we end up with a sort of an unfairly aggrandized notion of Western power in China. As if the British had single-handedly brought China low in the Opium War with their gunships, and with the Taiping, as I talked about in Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom, that they had single-handedly restored the Qing Dynasty to power. And a quote that I wish I had been able to bring into the book, but I didn't find it until later. Lloyd George, during the negotiations for the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, at one point mentioned that China would have been destroyed by the Taiping Rebellion if Gordon hadn't been there to organize her army. Again, a sort of this blasé belief by Lloyd George in 1919 that all that had mattered at the time was this one military officer, Chinese Gordon, going in and teaching the Chinese how to suppress this massive sectarian uprising. So what to do with this all? Could it have gone differently? Who knows? Who can speak for the British or the Chinese? What I want to leave you with, though, is a more hopeful vision of Chinese foreign relations coming out of this era, with two figures that I've been reading more about recently, who had a very close friendship. One, John Murray Forbes, an 18-year-old American from Boston, who had gone to work at a shipping firm in Canton, and the other, Ho Kwa, the head of the Canton merchants, who was reputed in the 1830s to be the richest man in the world. With a fortune of $26 million. The Forbes brothers had dealt in opium. John Murray Forbes' elder brother dabbled in opium. He himself did not, and Ho Kwa refused to deal in opium. He made his fortune selling tea and silk. And they became extremely close, and Ho Kwa viewed young John as something like a son. And there's a wonderful batch of letters from Ho Kwa to John Murray Forbes at Harvard's Baker Library when John was back in the United States. And they're mostly about business, and then there are little snippets of just affection. He talks about him like a son and how happy he's going to be when John finally comes back to China again, telling him news about his own son and how happy it makes him, telling John that there is no other foreigner who understands me as well as you do. And from this trust came a new kind of investment, not just sort of tea and opium and silk, but Ho Kwa began investing through John Murray Forbes in U.S. railroad bonds. At one point, young John invested $500,000 of Hoqua's money in American railroads. John himself would go on to be a railroad magnate. But this much more hopeful vision of taking that trade out of Canton, of allowing it to expand, of moving away from opium, something that could have happened on a different scale, perhaps. And I guess the last thing I will leave you with is an image. And a lot of, Autumn in the Heavenly Kingdom, I think, was born from a series of images. But in the course of my reading for this project thus far, the image that really just sticks in my mind the most, it disturbs me, and it, to me, captures the grim moral ambiguities of that war in China and the true horror of it. I think the Opium War gets sort of painted off as some sort of imperialist escapade and the British running up and down the coast of China when it was a brutal and horrible war. And this is from a letter from a close friend of John Murray Forbes, another young American who was living in Canton at the time after John had come back. His name was William Henry Lowe, and he was there for the Opium War as sort of an American observer. And he went to battlegrounds immediately after the battles had been fought, and what he saw there disturbed him so much that he ultimately actually would commit suicide a few years later. But there's one item from one of his letters where he describes a fresh battlefield. And this is one of the places where the Opium War becomes a truly human war, in my eyes, where he describes Chinese, as he described it, slaughtered like sheep, cut down by British soldiers. And he describes his revulsion at finding a mass grave where 300 bodies of dead Chinese had been hastily buried and covered over. And a British soldier had put up a sign there, horribly misspelled sign. So a semi-literate British soldier put up a sign on this grave in horribly misspelled English, which simply read, "This is the road that leads to glory." I'll leave you with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this lecture. Once again, a very sharp, a very clear analysis on the one hand, and a fantastic narrative on the other. So thank you. We do have time for a Q&A session. This is your opportunity to ask your questions to the speaker. Please.
Hi, good evening. Good evening.
Hi.
I enjoyed your talk. I have a question. Military historians generally identify the early 17th century as the period of time where Asian military technology essentially fossilized. That is, in modern parlance, they stopped investing in R&D. Mm-hmm. So while people mentioned that China had military success following that period, it was essentially with the same existing weapon systems.
Mm-hmm.
So how much do you think that played a factor in the non-deterrence when British decided to go to war, i.e., there was no effective deterrence that China could offer, especially along coastal defense? So.
All the way back to McCartney, actually. McCartney himself had said, if we send in a couple of gunships, we can strangle China from its ports. What China offered in the way of defense, however, and what the British feared, was land war. And they may have been armed with matchlock rifles that were long outdated. They may have been armed with swords and spears. But what you see repeatedly in the warnings against going to war in China are that if we are drawn into a land war with an empire of 300 million subjects, there's nothing we can possibly do. And one of the questions is, why didn't China fight a total war? There's indication that Lin Zexu was hoping for a total war of some kind on the other plane. The Qing dynasty was perfectly capable of fighting such wars. In the 17th century, the Emperor Kangxi evacuated the coast of China in order to fight against a massive pirate fleet. For 10 miles along the coast, they forced the residents to move inland and destroy the villages. So they were capable, even with outmoded military technology, of dealing with coastal threats. It's just something, there was no willpower for that at this time. And again, they were coming on the heels of the terrible crushing campaigns against the White Lotus, bankrupt treasuries, and ultimately they knew, and they banked on this and successfully, and again in the Second Opium War, that they knew that the British did not want to conquer China. They knew that they were not coming for the throne; that they just wanted trade, and ultimately that's what decided the appeasement.
The implications of your remarks are that decision makers have a tendency to misguide ideas and interpretations of events that are the context. The same is true today when many people keep saying that democracy will come to China because of capitalism, but sooner or later that's the way it's supposed to work. Despite the fact that the evidence has to work against it. So my question really, though, is if we lack the systematic methodology, either by business or by government, in terms of diplomacy or in terms of other things, to really try to look at things the way they really are, how do we really manage to bring about significant change?
I don't think anyone ever thinks that they are not looking at things as they really are. It's a matter of limitation of information. The decision makers then, as now, operate with what they believe to be the true conditions in another country.
But clearly you're pointing out that usually is not the case. So how do we change the system to make their views more accurate?
I'm not sure how you would change it exactly, but the lessons from the suppression of the Taiping Rebellion and the British intervention in the Taiping Rebellion, from my research there, is that much of it has to do with who you were listening to. And at the time of the Taiping, there were foreigners in China who actually had very clear ideas about what the Taiping represented, who were not listened to. I would not know how to pick them out of a given pool at a given time. And obviously, when we look backwards, the lessons that we learn are not so easily applied at the present day.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Professor. Thank you very much for the informative talk. I have one question about the naval development of the Qing Empire before the First Opium War. Mm-hmm. And you have mentioned that in your talk, there is a sizable number of coastal soldiers were sent or transferred to fight against the Mao Rebellion before the First Opium War, and as if it indicates that it is a turning point of the coastal defense in the Qing Empire. But as we know that, the Mao Rebellion was suppressed by the Qing government.
When who?
The Mao Rebellion.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. was suppressed in 1806. So, and the Opium War is in 1843. So I'm wondering, what's your comments about the naval development between 1806 to 1843, which covers almost 36 years? So that's my question. Thank you.
I've only just begun looking into this, so I don't have an enormous amount of information for you. But I would say that actually coastal officials in Guangdong tried to hire British gunships, actually, to work for them in fighting the pirates on the coast. And there was hope that they might be able to buy a few of these ships. Jane Austen's brother, actually, was in negotiations for quite a while to help the Qing suppress piracy on the coast. So I have not gone into very close detail yet. Again, this is a new project. But it seemed that they were fairly content to coast on the belief that if they did need help, they could get mercenary help from foreigners.
Okay, thank you.
Hi. I was just wondering, considering the delay in communications back in the time between London and the south of China, would you say that the responsibility for escalating the war, it was not more the responsibility, the actions of the local officials, the local British officials that were in South China, rather than the central power in London?
The locals didn't, until there was an actual representative there earlier on, they didn't have any authority to call the ships. They had to send to India and ask the Governor General of India to send a fleet. But again, by the time the launching of the Opium War came up for debate in Parliament, it was already underway. This also happens again with something the Taiping Rebellion. By the time anyone in England finds out about it, the decisions have already been made in India, or they've been made in secret in England, and the fleet's on the way. And that's generally how these things get pushed through against parliamentary opposition. Once it's already in motion, and once British troops are already at risk of their lives, in the end they will come along grudgingly and support it for the sake of their countrymen. So absolutely, the months that it would take to get information between London and Canton were crucial in her staging the opening of the war.
And on the basis of what information was the decision made to sort of declare war on China? You know, like, what was the crucial information?
Oh, there were several steps along the way, but it was the destruction of the opium, and very soon after that there was a kerfuffle in which a British was taken prisoner for, I believe it was for the murder of a Chinese citizen, either for a severe beating or a murder of a Chinese citizen. And there had been several events earlier in which British who were accused of a crime in Canton had been, even if it was an accident, they'd been taken and executed.
There's another microphone over there.
Oh, okay.
Hi. Thank you. You challenged the inevitable war in history. I'm from China. There is a popular interpretation of this history reducing to the idea of clash of civilizations. Because in thousands of years, East Asian especially in the center of China, working under so-called tributary system. Before the war, British should be adjusted to the system and to do trade with China. But in Western, there is another system called Westphalia system. These two systems are quite different. And there are non-stop clashes. When you see how the British contact with Chinese. So my question is, before the war, how the British justified the war in terms of international law? Because obviously after the war, British imposed the idea of international law to China, and China started to name China international law. Actually, at that time, reason found by a Chinese official was that the war we failed because we don't know the rules of Western international law. Thank you.
Excellent question. And certainly the tribute system comes into play when Macartney and then after him Lord Amherst are sent as emissaries to China and are asked to sort of bow and supplicate before the emperor, and they refuse to do that. That China's model of diplomacy was that embassies were to come to pay tribute, to recognize the superiority of the Chinese throne, whereas the British claimed all along that all they wanted was equality. I wasn't able to use it in the talk, but I would say as far as the most sanitized view of what the Opium War accomplished, to me came from a letter to Queen Victoria from Lord Stanley right afterwards commending her on the success in Afghanistan and the success in China, in which he said that, and this really sums up how they rationalized having fought the war, said, in China a termination has been put to the effusion of blood by the signature of a treaty which has placed your Majesty's dominions on a footing never recognized in favor of any foreign power, a footing of perfect equality with the Chinese Empire. And all these treaties were sort of ironically named treaties of peace and friendship, as if that is how they had been achieved. But certainly that question of international law is one that I've been tracing, because again there were many pamphlets written in Britain arguing that this was a blatant violation of international law, and you get this even in the voice of the opponent. You get this even, you know, earlier on in the 1830s with various officials saying that, you know, we have no right to dictate to the Chinese how to conduct trade in their own country, and I still haven't figured out exactly how they managed to derail all of those extremely legitimate arguments. Another argument that also gets derailed is that Britain has recently abolished slavery. And how is it that the country that holds itself up as the moral exemplar in abolishing slavery would then go to war for a group of drug dealers? This too, it's pointed out at the time. It's pointed out in the press. How do they move through that? Yeah.
Thank you very much, Professor, for your very fascinating talk. As you were talking, as you were telling us about the relationship between Forbes and Hokwok, one of my own passions is migration history, especially from the south of China to North America. And so one of the things, just a quick comment on that, is just I wonder how this would affect sort of the development of, I don't want to say Sino-American relations, but also specifically just very in the real human terms, the position and the development of Chinese Americans or Chinese Canadians sort of migrating across the Pacific. But just a very quick thing that came up in my mind. As we're talking about that. But my actual question is about the historical narratives of the Opium Wars, and specifically, there's this narrative about the so-called century of shame, really, that started from this period and didn't really finish until, depending on how you look at it, 1949 or 2008 with the Olympics. Yeah. depending on how you look at it. But anyway, my question really is just, it's a broader question, so please humor me a little bit with this. Where do you see sort of the movement of Chinese history, a study of it anyway, in either North America or even China, with respect to this framework of questioning these kinds of longstanding rhetorics of things like the century of shame, so to speak. Thank you.
Most contemporary history responds to it more than anything to its own moment, the moment in which it was written. Chinese history in the United States over past generations was written during World War II, when China was being devastated by Japan. It was written during the Cold War. It was written during the Cultural Revolution. It was then written by scholars who came of age in the Vietnam era and became more a narrative of Western oppression of the Chinese. I think a new history is emerging because we are now living in an era of a prosperous and powerful China. And the old narrative of Chinese weakness, which is the Opium War set in stone, as if China had always been that way, is fallacious. The reason to some people it seems sort of surprising and strange that China should become powerful, and how news commentators and pundits or whatever say, well, it can't possibly last, is because they're locked onto that notion of the century of shame. And if you turn back the clock 50 or 60 years before that, you find that actually China being powerful is not an anomaly. And in certain ways, the 1780s, 90s is in some ways a bookend for today, in a way that the Opium War is not. Actually, The Economist even sort of nailed this. And they had a cover a little while back with a picture of Xi Jinping dressed up as Qianlong. I think the headline was "Party Like It's 1793." I think this is happening both in China and amongst scholars in the United States, recognizing that actually there were great sources of strength back in this period. And furthermore, that if the decline of China began so precipitously in the late Qianlong era, how then did it survive all the way up into the 20th century? And obviously something was being done quite right by the government, that against all odds and against very strong social discontent, they were able to hold the empire together. So I think that's the direction things are going.
Thank you.
Professor, I really like you attempt to establish the causal link between the campaign against the White Lotus and the weak maritime defense. I like the idea that you said that because of the corruption existing in the campaign, the government take away the money which given to the military, and because it emphasized on, because of the warfare, which in the form of a building strong points in the rural area in order to squeeze the room for the rebels, which led the government to overlook the maritime defense. So I think I will launch a counter-argument is because for thousands of years, it is the north. Well, invasions normally come from the north. There's a very famous novelist called Lin Yutang, a Chinese one educated in the United States, I suppose. He wrote, in China, normally it is the northerners rule the country and the southerners own the country. So we can see from this observation that...
Did you say northerners run the country and southerners own the country?
Yeah, the northerners rule the country conquer, and the southerners own the country by their masterful financial abilities. Well, the point is here is all these conquerors normally since the unification of China, well, in 221 BC, all those invasions came down from the north, which this historical pattern conditioned the mentality of decision makers in the Qing court. And this is a deciding force that lead these well officials to overlook the maritime defense. So how do you
I think that's an excellent argument. Yeah, and especially the Manchus being themselves invaders from the north were far more preoccupied with troubles in Central Asia than they were with troubles along the coast, except at the time of Koxinga in the 17th century. The irony of Qing's strength was that they bankrupted themselves fighting border wars in Central Asia when ultimately it was going to be in the 19th century the coastal troubles that would really be their downfall. But I think your argument is a good one. I haven't sorted this out in a definitive way for myself yet. I haven't even started writing. But that viewpoint certainly is valid for the way the Manchus looked to Central Asia. I would point out that in Qing military history in general, the largest wars were fought essentially defensively in response to perceived threats. And the perception of a threat from Britain was extremely small, especially compared to the perception of a threat of a rebellion from within or from forces in Central Asia outside of the borders. This is not to say that the Chinese did not know that British gunships were powerful. They did. Macartney came with two men of war with 120 guns in 1793. In 1834, the Prussian missionary Charles Gutzlaff, who went secretly up the coast on an opium smuggling ship, reported that wherever they landed, the locals were terrified of them and talked about Macartney's ships. You know, that this had been handed down over the years. Similarly, the attempts to try to hire foreign ships to fight against pirates. I think Chinese maritime officials were well aware of how powerful the strength of the foreigners was, but they were not the ones making the decisive decisions about which wars should be fought. I would say also on the Mao Haijian, the Chinese scholar who's written really just the most fascinating book on the Opium War to come out in 20 years, points out that ultimately it was that when in the shifts between arguing what to fight the British or appease the British, it was the officials who were in the areas where the fighting was happening that were all calling for appeasement. And the drive to suppress was coming from officials in areas that weren't being affected, and they were all crying, let's go to war, let's show the British a lesson. Whereas the ones who actually came into contact were quite realistic about the abilities of the Qing Navy at that point.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. I certainly agree with you that the Chinese knew the European Navy is powerful since the Portuguese arrived in Macau. Mm. But anyway, my conclusion of your lecture is that I think that the Chinese Empire started to decline before the British, and the cause of decline is because the internal civil war cut quite low. So my analogy is that, is there any lesson to learn that now for our cousin in south of the border? Land of freedom. Free to be dumb. So the Congress is making a laughing joke at the end of the, around the world, so that they will one day blame China for sure, but I think that they start from themselves.
Woo! I will say the role of domestic disorder tends to be underestimated in hindsight. I can't quite make an intelligent analogy between what's going on in the U.S. right now. At least the kinds of internal we don't have sectarian uprisings; we have uprisings within Congress. I think the analogy now in the U.S. is far more to the era of the preceding the U.S. Civil War. China's problem had been and is how to discipline officials. and keep them away from corruption. How to maintain a centralized ideology that does not allow people to join into these large belief organizations that can potentially turn militaristic. Those were the primary problems facing China in the late Qianlong and Jiaqing eras of official corruption and movement of peasants into sectarian organizations. And that is those are the largest problems facing China now. Various kinds of sort of small-scale uprisings, groups that the government perceives as being quite dangerous, like Falun Gong, even though outsiders say, well, it's just a religious organization. And then somebody would point out, well, the Taiping were just a religious organization at the outset. And the ongoing campaigns against corruption, that these are things that are fairly constant for China in its very, very large structure. America has its own peculiar problems, which also can recur in various ways. But it's very hard to make political analogies between the two.
I was hoping that we would move on to the next point in our program at this point, but I see Professor Yates there.
Hi.
Who might want to ask the final last question.
Thank you very much, Professor Beck.
Hi.
It was a wonderful talk and wonderful answers to the questions. So if I may, I'd just like to ask you one final question, because you did mention the role of the missionaries prior to the Opium War, and of course the Taiping Rebellion, as you've just indicated, was sort of started by somebody who was perhaps certainly influenced by missionaries, and one could say that the result of the Opium War, one of the major results, was the opening of China to missionaries. Opening of China to missionaries much more, because I mean, what you've emphasized in your talk is more sort of the economic, military side of things, but the other dimension is the rapid spread of missionaries. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more of your current researches about the debates that were taking place in the missionary organizations and whether or to what extent there was any influence of the missionaries in the debates that led up to the Opium War. Or why was it that the missionaries benefited so much from the treaty that came out of the Opium War? Thank you very much.
Oh, this is a wonderful question. And I wish I had another half hour to talk about it. I won't be able to do it justice in the short amount of time that we have here, but I can say the reading that I have been doing, the missionaries that I have been following in this, because the missionaries play a fascinating role in the middle of this all. That they are coming to China ostensibly to save souls, to help the Chinese. Some of them come as doctors. They all fail miserably at converting anybody, for one thing. The very first Protestant missionary, Robert Morrison, and this is an important point to make. By the time of the Opium War, there was a close enough association between British traders and government figures and missionaries that they are almost working on a unified project. And the reason is that they need the missionaries because the missionaries speak Chinese. James Flint had been the only Englishman in his time who could speak Chinese. There was always a shortage of any Englishman who could speak Chinese, and that's what the missionaries could do. What I was going to say is that Robert Morrison, when he first went to China in the early 19th century, wasn't even allowed to sail on an East India Company ship because they saw missionaries as being troublemakers. He had to sail all the way to New York, and he sailed from there all the way to China, where he found out that he couldn't live in Macau because the Portuguese were Catholics and they didn't want him there as a Protestant, and he found the East India Company wouldn't let him live in their factory. So he sort of hid out with the Americans and had secret teachers teach him Chinese. But there's this transformation that takes place. The intense frustration of the missionaries who want to get into China but can't. And they make these amazing moral compromises in order to try to gain that access. None more vivid than Charles Gutzlaff, the insane Prussian missionary, who he ultimately works for Jardine, the lead opium trader, as an interpreter on a ship that he sends illegally up and down the coast. And Gutzlaff's rationale was that better to be able to go along and distribute my little Bible tracts as we pull into port than to be stuck down in Canton like these other poor saps who are following the rules. Gutzlaff actually becomes, he serves temporarily as a military governor on Joshan during the war. In some of the Chinese sources, he appears as sort of the Machiavellian force behind the entire British side. But, I mean, the irony is, Robert Morrison, I think to his dying day, believed in sort of good works for China, that he was dead set against the opium trade. He died in 1834 as a deeply revered figure in the foreign missionary community. His son was one of the lead negotiators of the Treaty of Nanking. He was one of the lead interpreters for that. And sort of from then forward, you find missionaries in an extremely compromised position of diplomatic translators. And actually sorting out their stories is going to be like I think one of the part of the research that I'm looking forward to the most in some ways. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd now like to hand it over to Justin Fletcher, the president of the AUS Society.
Professor Platt, on behalf of this audience today, we'd like to thank you for your thought-provoking lecture. The Kundal Prize offers you this plaque as a token of appreciation for your lecture and for being the fifth Kundal Prize winner. So congratulations and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The last word comes from me. First of all, I want to thank Justin for making that presentation. Justin is, as Hans said, the president of the Arts Undergraduate Society. He's also a U4 student in honors East Asian Studies with minors in anthropology and political economy, so a fitting choice to make the presentation. Again, I want to thank Stephen for his lecture today and congratulate him again for winning the prize last year. You do honor to McGill University and to the Kundal Prize for all the work that you continue to do. I want to thank the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, which plays a critical role in organizing not only the prize, but also this lecture. So thank Joanne Bilodeau and our entire team at MISC for all the hard work that they do on this. And my final word is, please join us for a cocktail. So thank you very much.